Good evening, everybody, or it's evening here. My name is Aaron Devotuttle, once again, coming to you from Kiryat Moshe, Jerusalem, Israel. And hope you enjoyed getting to know me a little bit yesterday. Today, I'd like to go a little bit deeper, kind of scratch the surface yesterday, but I'd like to go a little bit deeper in letting you know about my background, how I got here. How the heck did I get here, huh? It's a good question. One that we hopefully all take stop and pause to reflect. How did we get here? And are the ways that we've been using to get around and move in the world and relate to people, are they really serving us or not? Do we know? Do we have some idea of what our purpose is in this life? Where are we going to be here, you know, whatever, 70, 80, 90 years? The time, you know, our time is precious. And, you know, how do I find a balance between taking that seriously and not taking it too seriously or not taking myself too seriously? So that's... it's an important question to be asking. And how I got here is, I suppose it sort of started, I'm from San Francisco, California. And I grew up in a non-observant, a fairly non-religious family, a pretty secular family. My father, who is not Jewish, but went through a reform conversion when I was about 20 years ago, when I was like 15, and considers himself connected to the Jewish people and Jewish tradition to a to some extent, as my mother is also, you know, my mother's Jewish. And I grew up without really any strong religious upbringing. My mother's parents were quite unreligious, actually, as was common with many German Jews of that generation. So the generation that survived the war. German Jews have been assimilated for quite some time. When I started becoming religious about 8 years ago, it was really a it's an interesting kind of question to reflect on. Is, well, how do I know I'm Jewish? I can say with a pretty high level of certitude that I am that I was born Jewish. And yeah, so I grew up in that house, and didn't really get a lot of insight into how to negotiate my inner world, how to navigate my inner world. I was very sensitive, very intelligent, and those things made me stand out amongst my peers. And I was given very kind of primitive tools for learning how to deal with that. Nothing that really helped me. They were just kind of ways of, like, for example, you know, if I got picked on by kids in the neighborhood, I got told by my parents several times that, well, they're just jealous, which is, that might be, but it doesn't help me it doesn't resolve what I'm feeling. It doesn't help me resolve what I'm feeling. It doesn't help me feel understood. Which kind of just makes me feel even more like an outsider. And more than that, I felt in a way superior. Well, you know, if I'm so much of a better person than you, that you're making fun of me because of how insecure you are. Well, how great must I be? And I started to develop a pretty inflated sense of ego from a young age. And Oh, it's very and very a very critical eye as well. So that those two things, a tremendous intellectual arrogance and a very critical and harsh and judging nature, not nature, but inclination. Those things have accompanied me till this day. And but at least now today I have much better and more powerful tools for dealing with them, for managing those things. So basically, when I was 12, we left the town where we'd been living, called Daly City, and we moved to another part of the San Francisco Bay Area, a much more affluent part of the San Francisco Bay Area, and lived there. That was when I was about 12. And 12, if as you're probably aware, 12 years old is a pretty formative age. We came to the school district where I started. Middle school had already begun for most of these kids a year before. I was starting in seventh grade for most of these kids. They'd been together since elementary school, or at least sixth grade the previous year. And so I was joining kind of a social scene already in progress, or I was approaching a social scene already in progress. Again, very intelligent, very sensitive. I like to kind of geek out on things, and just did not really fit in well with anybody. Even the kids that I hung out with that would become my friends, I didn't really feel like I fit in with them so well. I lived a pretty lonely and miserable existence for, I'd say, the next 7 years, varying degrees of magnitude and severity. It just things just seemed to kind of get worse and more painful. Started having difficulty sleeping. Always had difficulty in school. Never, ever, ever have I liked doing homework. Never, ever, ever have I liked studying for tests. I was usually pretty, which was actually not so bad because I was usually smart enough that I could, and knowledgeable enough just from coming to class that I could do well on a test without much preparation. I'm also a very good writer. So that helped me later on in high school and university for written exams. But yeah, not never very studious. I was always very distracted by things, and never just could did not have any self-discipline to just sit put in one place and do the thing that I was really supposed to be doing, or that other people were expecting me to do. And always felt, a sense of resentment that I even had to do it in the first place, a sense of entitlement that I had to do it in the first place. Kind of things kind of went on like that. Socially, I was, still the same kind of situation. Didn't really know how to talk to girls. I had maybe like a couple. Maybe like a handful of girls that I had, had like summer, a little like summer kind of romance with, but never went very far. Things never went very far. Never made it past August. When I was 15, things changed. So as I was saying, when I was 15, things took a rather interesting turn. Without going into all the details, because it's not really my place to speak about it. I lost all faith and trust in my father and my parents. My parents, and specifically my father. And not long after that, I left the Reformed Jewish community that we had been part of, And that was that. I basically said, if I thought, you know, to myself, you know, if this is all Judaism had to offer, then I wasn't too impressed. And just kind of went about my life, my miserable, lonely, depressing life. Playing a lot of video games and I wonder if I should say this, and masturbating a lot, like, you know, like a lot of teenage boys do. And and I was, you know, that was what I did, and not doing very well in school, not really getting along so well with, you know, not having a lot of friends, not being accepted by the cool kids, not getting a lot of attention from girls, or at least not enough, not of the kind that I really wanted. And although when I did get attention from girls, it was electric, it was intoxicating. I could get drunk on that kind of, on intense flirtation, or if a girl would, you know, a pretty girl would, like, you know, turn around and draw on my arm or whatever, which is something girls at my high school used to do. Of course, I never got any phone numbers, and I wouldn't have even known how to ask for it. It was very, very awkward. And even at one point, I had a girl, there was a girl that I was dating who was a year older than me, which was already pretty cool. And she was, like, pretty cool, also kind of a bit of a social misfit. And one night we were over at her house watching a movie, and we were cuddling, and we go into her bedroom afterwards, and she obviously was anticipating that we were going to have sex, but I had never had sex before, so I didn't know what was going on. I didn't read the cues, and just kind of ended up being very awkward, and she ended the relationship within a day or two. And that was very disappointing. It wasn't for, I don't remember how long it was afterwards that I realized really what that situation was about, what she was really, what was going on there, that she had expected to have, you know, that she had expected to have relations with me. And I just didn't know. But when I did realize that, it was, my MO kind of became never again. You know, that's a big recurring theme with a lot of emotional traumas that we experience, you know, regardless of severity. You know, we get where we allow ourselves to be vulnerable, or we are vulnerable, and we get hurt in a particular way. And there's part of our mind, part of our heart kind of breaks. Except instead of breaking open, which is something that can happen, which is a healthy kind of brokenheartedness, it breaks closed, and we close off, and we shut part of ourselves down, and we create this we close off a section of our heart, and we say, never again, I'm never going to let this happen again. And we spend a lot of energy and we spend a lot of energy trying to protect ourselves from being hurt in that way again. And that is what I did. And I decided, and in my case, it came out in the form of, several years later, when I sort of learned how to put myself out there to the opposite sex, my MO was basically never to miss an opportunity. And I spent, from when I was 19 and basically the first half of my 20s, engaging in pretty irresponsible and at times reckless, and a lot of just insane sexual behavior. I'll spare you most of the gory details, but it got pretty nuts at times, no pun intended. So also around 15, or sorry, excuse me, when I was 17, or just before I turned 17, is when I was introduced to marijuana and alcohol. And I also lost my virginity that same summer, to a girl who I was not particularly attracted to, but she evidently thought I would be a good, kind of summer fling. And so that happened rather, so I lost my virginity rather uneventfully in a very non-spectacular way. And I came back to my senior year of high school, basically just wanting to be high all the time. That was what I learned from that experience. And that's what I did. I within weeks of, well, mo I mean months, weeks, whatever, of that first time of getting drunk and high, I just set out to be as high as often as possible, and found other people, and found that there were many, many other people in my high school class who were, sort of in similar, had a seemingly a similar goal or aspiration, and I found ways to lie and manipulate and cheat and steal to attain that goal of being high as often as possible. I would, steal from my parents. My parents were recreational marijuana users, and so I learned how to steal from them without getting noticed, and I had a scheme with where I, stealing a test from, I was a teacher's assistant, and I knew how to break into or unlock the drawer of this teacher where she kept her tests, and so I could steal the test and make photocopies and distribute it and get reimbursed in marijuana and social credibility as well. And basically, anybody who knows anything about 12-step programs knows what unmanageability is. And so my last year of high school was one long unmanageable train wreck. And yeah, wherein I was basically under the influence of marijuana as often as I possibly could, and finding ever increasingly more intense ways to smoke it, and ended up not really graduating high school. I failed my senior year English class, and so did not graduate in the same time frame as the rest of my peers. Had to make up that class that summer. And my reckless behavior only increased. I basically dropped. I didn't go straight to college or university after high school. I started working, and at that job, met a guy who introduced me to a black sticky substance, which he called opium. Turned out to be black tar heroin. I later learned that it's actually quite common for people to be introduced to black tar heroin by somebody calling it opium. That actually happens more often than you'd think. That I in so in heroin, I thought I found the answer to my problems. The sense of relief and comfort and warmth that it offered, and release that it offered, was really what I'd been, I craved it deeply. I yearned for it deeply. It was a very, and that, there's really, there's nothing like it. It's heroin, the physical and the mental and the emotional and really the spiritual release that it offers is, there's nothing like it. There really isn't. Of course, the problem is, among other things, is that it is extremely addictive, and You know, it's not long before I had to, you know, use it every day. Otherwise, I would experience withdrawal. And of course, I was, you know, it kills your relationships because it killed my relationships because, you know, I had to lie and cheat and steal even more in order to get more of it. And then also along the line, I was smoking crack there for a while because it's very easily obtainable in this from the same people that sell the heroin, which is, you know, the ghettos of the street corners of the ghettos in the East Bay of Northern California, of the San Francisco Bay Area. And yeah, so that's kind of how my life, so my life basically came kind of grinding to a halt at that point. Didn't really have much going on, not too many friends, wasn't working, wasn't in school. It was very pathetic. It was a very, very pathetic situation, you know, and I was 18 years old. I was 18 years old, and this is what my life was about, was smoking heroin and stealing money or whatever, writing bad checks to cash, to get more drugs, to get heroin. By the way, I never used a needle, which is something I'm still grateful for. Because I know from people who've told me that needle use is itself, the experience of needle use is very addictive, and also just the way the drug is released into the bloodstream, the way it affects the user is more intense, is much more intense. And I like intense experiences. That's definitely part of my personality. So that's basically, that brings me up to my 19th birthday. And not long after my 19th birthday, I was arrested and spent a night in jail and started trying to get help and started going to 12-step meetings and got into an outpatient treatment center, which, the difference between outpatient, there's outpatient as opposed to inpatient. So inpatient is like a 28-day kind of rehab where you go to a place, you go to a facility where you have, you know, a dormitory or that kind of thing. And they have counselors and staff on hand at all times to address the needs of the clients. Outpatient is where there is an office that where you go however many times a week, and a few nights a week. And sit, you know, have groups and talk about what's going on, kind of a more extended 12-step meeting. I don't know how else to describe it. I don't really, my memory of that period is pretty foggy, but I did not stay clean for very long. I started using again shortly thereafterward, and lied about my dirty tests. And which they never called me on. I later learned, I now know that a lot of it has to do with the structure of the way rehabs are. They're nonprofits, but they receive some state funding, and I believe that they receive state funding based on how many enrollees they have, and they also receive. They also get money from, you know, the people who are enrolled from the clients, and so it's in their interest. Actually, it's in their financial interest to, because they're always these nonprofits are always kind of scraping for funding, a lot of them anyway. Maybe not now. I don't know. This is a while ago. This is 15 years ago. And so it's actually, but it's the long story short, it's in their interest to not confront people who lie and continue using drugs and drinking while they're in treatment, while they're in these programs. So it was very easy for me to skate and get by, and I was lying to the treatment center, and then eventually I started lying to my parents and using and instead of going to groups, instead of going to the outpatient, I would go over to where I was getting drugs and just buy drugs and using. And eventually my dad called me on that as well. And you know, kind of pushed me to go to a 28-day treatment center, which I wanted on some level at that point. I was ready to, you know, to like not have a miserable, lonely existence anymore. And so I allowed myself to get, you know, to kind of get pushed into this, into a 28-day place, a residential, you know, inpatient place, also in West Marin, very fancy schmancy place, you know, beautiful setting in the hills of Marin County with all the redwoods around, the, you know, lush redwood forest. You know, the treatment where, you know, a number of celebrities have been through, you know, Marin County, you know, it's a very, very wealthy bedroom community. And so it's like very kind of upper crust, you know, guilty white liberal, type of place. Yeah. And so that's where I went. And my parents were not from, you know, we don't have that kind of money necessarily, but you know, for the, my parents were willing to, you know, obviously it's, you know, I'm their only son, you know, they're willing to put up the money to help me for sure. So I'm grateful for that. And that was really where I got, where the ideas of 12-step recovery started to kind of creep in. And, yeah, so that began my recovery journey. And that was when I was 19 years old, and started my recovery journey at that point, and began to, you know, got out and was living in a sober living house, lived in that sober living house for 10 months, and got a job and was going to meetings and started going back to school and, you know, started trying to like get a, you know, get some kind of normalcy and, you know, some normalcy back in my life, and started getting friends from the meetings I was going to and from the 12-step meetings I was going to, and started meeting girls also, meeting girls at work, whether they were customers or coworkers or, you know, girls from meetings. And I, yeah, I just, I started, I really liked, I just really, really enjoyed meeting the thrill, and the challenge of meeting a girl and trying to convince her to have sex with me. And that desire really only intensified over, you know, over the period of the next 5-6 years, became more and more prominent, and the extent to which I would go to satisfy that craving got pretty scary, you know, got pretty wild when I look back on it. Yeah. So, yeah, so that continued, and my life sort of continued along a pretty, I guess, straightforward and conventional path for the next 6 years. You know, had some fun experiences, had some not so fun experiences. Got my bachelor's degree in music, basically because for the same reason I mentioned before, I don't like studying or doing homework, and music was a good way for me to avoid both of those things. Majoring in music was a good way for me to avoid doing both of those things. And so I got my degree, and I took my sweet ass time getting my bachelor's degree. I think I was like 25, 26 when I officially wrapped up my bachelor's degree. Yeah, because really, like, if you look at a pie chart of the time that I spent, when I could have been studying or, you know, in the practice room of the music building with my instrument, which is trombone, by the way, you look at a pie chart of all the time I spent, you would think that I was that I majored in video games and girls. Really, it was, I was very undisciplined, very immature, very irresponsible. And yeah, so that brings us right up to that, you know, we're reaching the half hour mark of this podcast, this episode. And it brings us right up to my trip to Israel, my first trip to Israel on Birthright. And yeah, so I hope you have hope you've enjoyed listening. And I don't know what if anything you heard that you could have that you relate to or connect to or appreciate or found meaningful or but if anybody found if hopefully somebody found something meaningful from what I had to share. And I will be back tomorrow with the continuation. Take care. See you then.